Heavenly Father, today we put on the full armor to protect us against attack. We put on the belt of truth to protect against lies and deception. We put on the breastplate of righteousness to protect our hearts from the temptations. We put the gospel of peace on our feet to walk in your light, peace, and freedom with the Holy Spirit. We rebuke anxious thoughts. We take up your shield of faith for protection to block and destroy all the darts and threats thrown at us by the enemy. We put on the helmet of salvation to cover our minds and thoughts, reminding us that we are children of a mighty King. We are forgiven, set free, saved by the blood of Jesus. We take up the sword of the Spirit, your living word, that has the power to demolish strongholds and is sharper than any double-edged sword. We come to you, Lord, in prayer daily. In Jesus' mighty name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
What's up, you guys? Welcome to The Imagination. I'm your host, Emma, and this is a very special episode that I'm really excited for. This week, we're honored to introduce to you someone we are so thrilled to have on, who we met through a mutual friend and former guest on my podcast, John Paul Rice. When John reached out about doing this interview, I knew it would be an amazing show full of value. So joining us this week is Tracy Minchin, founder and director of the Ruby Organization. In their words on their website, the Ruby Organization is a registered 501c3 nonprofit organization located in Carrabas County, North Carolina. In coordination with other area service providers, we offer resources and mentoring for women seeking to leave the sex industry or are victims of human trafficking. We provide awareness training for the community and have a field team working with women in area strip clubs and the sex industry to offer hope and opportunity. Now, one of the many reasons I'm excited to speak to Tracy today is because one of the most frequent questions I get asked is, what can I do to get involved in this fight against human sex trafficking? And my hope is this episode inspires you to walk away with amazing insight on how to research organizations that exist in your area, while also giving you some tools on what questions to ask and what to look for in your own communities, whether it's through your own eyes, understanding that this takes place, or in your own quest to take action. The other reason I'm excited to have Tracy on is because we're going to talk about an element of sex trafficking that I haven't covered very in depth often on my podcast, adult sex trafficking. If you've been following for a while, you've heard many stories of the horrific things that happen to children when they are born or sold into these horrific systems. But what happens to that child down the road if they never leave or escape the system? What happens to the naive and vulnerable adult woman who wasn't born into the system, but who may get promised money, a lavish lifestyle, fame and fortune, only to be thrown into a strip club and end up being trafficked and abused? The adult entertainment industry is a cesspool of human trafficking, and we should all be so grateful that someone like Tracy volunteers her time and energy to rescue women out of these abusive systems. So you guys, without further ado, please help me in introducing Voice for the Voiceless, human trafficking advocate and real life superhero, Tracy Minchin. Tracy, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Hi. Wow, that was a big introduction. I don't know if I can stand up to that, but I will try.
Oh, you are just amazing. I'm really honored to have you on. Like I said, you know, when John Paul Rice sends a recommendation, you definitely have to look into it. And I thought it was really interesting what you were doing. So just thank you for being here. I think people are going to get a lot of value of this. Now, for people who haven't heard of the Ruby Organization, who might not know who you are, I'd love to hear some background on, you know, kind of maybe how you grew up and some things about you and what led you into getting into this.
Sure. You know, I think first and foremost, you know, you never understand this growing up, but, you know, God uses everything for his purpose. And you may not know it, and I never knew it, but I grew up, I grew up in a small town not far from Charlotte, North Carolina. And we're still right outside Charlotte, North Carolina. But I grew up with a father who was in a band, and he played in bars and clubs, and they used to take me with them. Like, as a child, I grew up in bars and clubs. And the interesting thing is now that, you know, that's not exactly probably the most great childhood to grow up in bars and clubs. You get to learn a lot of things very quickly and experience a lot of things, but now it helps me effectively lead a team into these clubs and be completely at home and be completely at peace when I go in, because I'm very comfortable there. So the girls that we, the women we encounter, feel very comfortable because I have that comfort level. The team feels very comfortable because not all of them had that experience growing up. And so when they see me comfortable in a situation, that makes the team comfortable in a situation. So for me to walk into, now granted, I didn't grow up in strip clubs and brothels and things like that, but the atmosphere in general is very comfortable to me. So God used that in preparation my whole life. And you know, you never have a clue until it's time to use it.
That is so fascinating. When you were younger, did you have any awareness of this type of thing happening? Or did you have parents that kind of talked to you about it? Or do you look back now and you're like, oh my gosh, I was so close to the fire even there?
Yeah. Yes. And no, I mean, nobody spoke of that. I mean, nobody even knew really about it. It was still going on, but nobody really knew. It's not like today where you can have discussions and it's in movies and TV and things like that. It's just wasn't talked about. And I don't know how many times I was close to that. I have no idea. I never felt scared or threatened or uncomfortable, but I also didn't know any different. So that gives you that perspective of that was normal for me. So it would be that same way for a person growing up in that environment. It would seem normal, right? So, so as an adult, I was actually in a business professional women's club. And we had a meeting one night, and our guest speaker was a person who has an organization here, and they work with children in trafficking, and they are fantastic.
Wow.
We know them very well. We operate in different circles just because of the demographic that we serve, but we have the same mission mind. And they came and spoke, and I remember sitting there trying to eat my dinner, and I just couldn't even eat dinner. And, you know, God had put that in my gut right then and went, how can you know this and sit here? How can you know this is happening? North Carolina is sixth in the nation, and our area is number one in our state. So I just sat there going, how can you know this is happening and just sit and do nothing? How can that be? I can't. And so I went on my first international mission trip to Moldova, which is the most trafficked country in Europe. And goodness, it was life-changing. Came back from that mission trip, and this has been about 4 years ago. Came back from that mission trip. I knew I needed to do something in this world, in the trafficking world. I didn't know what it was. I didn't feel called and led to work with children. I just didn't. But I really had a heart for those women. The women who get thrown away because people are like, oh, they're adults. They can just get out of it. They're adults. They can just leave. They're doing this by choice. And they just get kind of thrown to the wayside more times than not, even by law enforcement, because they're adults. They can make a decision. And that's just not necessarily true. And most times it's not true. And there's so many factors in their past that have led them to that point in their life, that that's where they are. And so I really kind of felt like I had the heart for that. So started doing a lot of research, met with some other ministries that visit strip clubs, because we thought that would be a good place to start. And believe it or not, we call the strip clubs and say, we're women that want to come visit. Can we come? And it's yes. You can come and visit. And
gosh, did you tell them why? Did you tell them who you are, or just, hey, we just want to come in and check it out?
No, we're very honest, because we feel like if they check us out and we're lying, they're going to ask us not to come back. So we don't rescue anybody. You can't rescue an adult. They do make decisions to a degree on their own. We are seed planters. So our hope is to go in and build, and it takes a very long time to build these relationships. They're used to everybody wanting something from them. It's you wouldn't offer me that friendship for nothing. That's their view. And so you have to actually build that relationship with them and break those walls down. And it can be at the beginning, it's very superficial. Like, I'm getting a new haircut. Which one do you like? It's very superficial until you build that relationship, just like you would with any other person, where the conversations get much deeper of, you know, I'm homeless. My boyfriend stabbed me. I don't want to be here. Or, you know, even down to a girl that I know last week who does not work in the sex industry, who said, a man came up to me at the gas station and offered me, and he was in like a Lexus, and offered me $3,000 if I would come and be on his site. I mean, that's at the gas station here, like at 7 o'clock at night, and she's pumping gas. So you build those relationships so that when the hard stuff comes up and when you need to have those deep conversations and when you can give some hope and some direction, that they're willing to talk to you about that, and you're able, and they have some confidence in you as a person, that you're not going to steer them in the wrong direction when they need help. So it's a very long process. I mean, some of these women we've been working with for years, that we've had relationship with for years. And so that's really how I got into it. And it kind of snowballed into the Ruby organization. We decided that what we were doing wasn't enough. So we decided we needed to put an education portion together. So we speak to groups and we have that education portion. We work with trafficking victims one-on-one individually to kind of create their success path. And we work with their families, because a lot of the times the families just don't understand what that means. And then, of course, we have that very strong presence in brothels and strip clubs, where we're there multiple times a month. And we even end up ministering to the management, believe it or not. It really is, you know, when you can gather around a bartender who has cancer, and in the middle of the brothel that is full of people, and you just start, you know, your group starts in this fierce prayer where everybody can hear you. And all of a sudden the other girls are kind of gathered around praying in agreement. It's like God can use anybody anywhere. And we get to see that.
That's beautiful. What an inspiring story. I love that you did something similar to how I got into podcasting. It, like you said, you just got that feeling in your gut and just automatically felt called, you know? And mm-hmm. The strange thing to me is how many other people understand that this is happening and don't feel that way, you know? But that's why it's so important that people like you are out there talking about it over and over again to people who, especially in those demographics, they're so desensitized to all of that going on around them. It becomes normal. Everybody that they're around is going through something, you know? Right. So especially in those environments, that has to be very challenging to have those conversations.
Sure. Sure. And we have so many women that are like, you know, what you guys do is like incredible. And it's like, it really isn't. We just go. We're being obedient. We're going to be obedient. We're going to be consistent. And we just go, and we never know what we're walking into. Even if it's a venue that you've been going for years, the environment's always different depending on who's there. The dynamic of the women is different depending on if there's new girls working. So you just kind of have to, you walk in the door and you're going to roll with it, basically. You know, we just kind of trust God to kind of guide our conversations and guide those relationships. And, you know, honestly, we have women, believe it or not, and I think we may do a workshop at our church, because there are women that, to be honest, they understand, but they're like, what would I say? I mean, they are afraid. And believe me, it's out of everybody's comfort zone. It is not in anybody's comfort zone to walk into a strip club and walk up to a stripper and introduce yourself and have to explain who you are and that you don't want anything and you're not trying to take them to Jesus and you're not trying to, because that's the last thing you want to do. They'll shut down. We fit anything in there prayer-wise and gospel-wise when we can. Sometimes it's in little gifts that we give them that might have a scripture on it. But we don't really ever talk about it a whole lot unless they ask, because they will shut down. They have been Christians. A lot of times have put a bad taste in their mouth at some point. They've had a very bad experience, and we want to show them, not tell them. So we want to show them that love and compassion and that grace. And we don't want to tell it. Everybody tells them everything. We just don't want to tell them. So we really don't. So it really is a unique way to approach it all.
Amazing. I know that people on the other end are probably listening, and I feel in the future questions that people are asking. I want to break down a little bit of really what you see going in there and kind of what you've learned. So first of all, what makes somebody a vulnerable person to be a victim or a potential victim for strip club trafficking? And then maybe explain how could that happen in a strip club, and kind of what is that? You know, what is sex trafficking look like in a strip club, and how is that happening?
Sure. So honestly, all of us are susceptible to trafficking. Everybody. And if somebody says, oh, they could never do that to me. Oh, yes, they could. All they need to do is threaten to take your child. All they need to do is threaten to burn your parents' house down. If somebody is in a vulnerable moment in their life, and we all are at some point, all it takes is that person to come along and threaten the right thing. Or if you're financially in a bad situation, offer the right thing. That's really all it takes. And in the strip club, there's a couple of things. There's a couple of scenarios going on. Number one, there are trafficking girls that are being trafficked in there, that also outside of that, having to work in the porn industry, print work. They're made to do a lot of those things. It's also a heavy recruiting area, because most of those girls in there are there because they need money. And somebody comes in, they become a regular, they're a groomer, they become a regular, they get to know the girls, they get to know that this particular girl has 3 children and her car's break down. He's going to offer to fix her car. So that's a recruiting step. So it's twofold in there. Then you honestly do have your girls who are in college, or a single mom who has like a day job and has to do that at night. And those are the ones you really want to latch on really quickly and encourage them out of that, if you can help them find a way out of that, because they don't have those types of bondage necessarily that are, you know, and it's also drug related. I mean, a lot of drug dealers go to the clubs, and that's where the girls get their drugs. So there's a lot of dynamics, a lot of different dynamics going on inside one of those clubs. A brothel's completely different. A brothel's one thing and one thing only. And we do have one that we attend multiple times a month and have for a couple of years. And that's a whole nother, you know, you have to approach that with a whole different dynamic than you do a strip club. We know what's going on. I mean, and in the strip club, you know, 99% of the time, the girls just don't strip. It always is leading, or they're making money elsewhere. You know, whether it's in a VIP room, whether it's after hours because they have regulars, or they're in the porn industry. So typically it is not just stripping. It's rare that you find a girl that is just stripping. And they may start that way, but it usually goes into everything else.
I appreciate you bringing that up, because I think it's not that it's out of people's minds to conceptualize that this would happen, but I think it's like you said, people just, they think, oh, you know, stripping's really bad, she's doing that, you know, and they're not thinking about, like you said, all the other things that they're doing maybe when they get off their shift or on a break or after hours or before hours, you know, and that the industry, the adult industry, is very tied in with each other. It's not, and it's the same thing for, you know, pornography. Like there's a lot of those, the people that are in that industry cross over into the other aspects of it, like what you said, you know? So I think opening up people's minds to just see, you know, how people just get passed around and used. And like you said, now there's blackmail against them if they're doing these things. So now not only are they threatened to get in there, but there's constantly probably things that are keeping them there because they feel so threatened and so controlled, so bound to the people that are, in a sense, controlling them.
Well, sure. And you have a girl who maybe had a really rough childhood, maybe even left home at like 16. She's 23, 24 years old, and she's working in an upscale club, and she's making $1,000 a week and driving a Mercedes. It is very difficult to convince her or even have a conversation that that's a dangerous lifestyle, that that is not a lifestyle that she needs to be a part of, and that she really is in danger. And she really is, if she's not into things, she is really susceptible to that. And they become desensitized too, where all the things around them, when they first start, they're like, oh, I would never do that. Yeah, eventually they would. And so it's really difficult to go and talk to a girl that's making $100,000 a year and convince her this is just not good for you. This is not a good place for you. And it, you know, you really can't. It's that relationship that you have to build so that they, you know, when they start, you know, we're seed planters, and it takes years. And sometimes you don't see the fruit of that as a seed planter. And that's okay. We're doing what we're called to do, and that's to be consistent and obedient and be there and love them. Because our outlook is, no matter if they're in the porn industry, if they're stripping, if they're trafficked, if they're in the brothel, it doesn't matter what part of that they're in. We consider that a situation, not who they are. There are people behind that. There's reasons they're there. Nobody wakes up when they're 10 years old and says, when I grow up, I want to be a stripper. I want to be a prostitute. I want to be trafficked. I want to be in porn videos. Nobody says that when they're 10 years old. Nobody says that when they're 15 years old. So there's always trauma. There's always abuse. There's always something that gets them to that point where either they have no choice or they feel like they have no choice. And we like to build that relationship so that we can get to that point. That's when we can do some work. That's when we can really talk them through things and give them some hope and encouragement, and sometimes suggest some options if they're open to that. We don't push that because they'll shut down. But there is times that they're like, do you know how I could do this? Do you know how, you know, and they'll just ask simple questions. And we, you know, we want them to come to us for those questions because we don't want anything from them. We're going to be honest with them. We do have their best interest at heart. And most people they meet don't. And it really is that relationship building. So for us, we don't always get to see the fruit of that. But you know what? When you pull into a strip club and you haven't been there in a couple weeks, and the girls get out of the car to go in and they're like, oh my gosh, we were wondering when you were coming back. That's a win for us. They're thinking about us outside of us being there. We're having an influence on them outside of that, you know. And a couple of weeks ago, we gave out these little pretty little tins with like mints in them, right? And we just every once in a while, we'll just take something little as a conversation starter, especially if it's somebody new that's kind of standoffish. So there was a new girl and she's in the brothel and we introduce ourselves, right? And she's really tall. And her stage name is Ivy. And I said, well, is your name Ivy because you're tall? She's like, I'm not that tall. She's like, it's the shoes. I said, oh, compared to me, you're tall. She said, well, let's see. So she takes the shoes off and we're doing comparison. And I was like, see, I still win. I'm the shortest one. And, you know, so you have to kind of break that ice with them, you know? And so we give her this little tin of mints, right? And one of our team members is having a conversation with her. And we go back a couple weeks later and she says, you know what? This week I was eating my mints and I was wondering if you guys would come back.
Aww.
Yeah, we get hugs going in and hugs going out, you know? And so we know, even though we may not ever see the end fruit of that, we do see the impact.
That's so huge. And I love too that you brought up, you know, the abuse being involved with a lot, or I would argue 100% are going through something that isn't very visible to the outside world.
Yes.
You know, and that was one of the, I had an interview with this girl who that basically happened to her. She was she grew up in an abusive family. Mm-hmm. That's all she knew. So, and they are pretty vulnerable too, to, you know, not being able to get jobs later on in life or not being able to hold a job if you have. Yeah. And some of them have never had financial freedom, depending on if that was controlled. Maybe they don't have a way that they can go get a regular job. And that's kind of what their, you know, option is in their right. mind in those moments. They don't feel like they have resources for anything else.
You know?
And so I love that you guys are able to identify that, you know, because that's so important. I think society, we have this very skewed vision of these industries. We see it for what it is, entertainment almost, and we look down right. on it. And like you said, we say, why would you do that? You have a choice every day. You didn't have to do that. That's gross. Like, I'm not, you know, you're not a child. You can make up your own mind, and it's disgusting that that's your choice. And it's like,
right.
okay, well, if you have everything taken from you, you've been abused your whole life, that's all that you know is coercive control and abuse, rape, potentially, if that's something you yes. went through. That's a very normal, unfortunately, it's a, you know, kind of a normal pathway for somebody that doesn't get help or love or intervention along the way. That's a very big possibility that they're going to keep, you know, somehow end up continuing to be abused. And that's one of the big ways, in a way that they can legally make money for something that comes very naturally and kind of normal to, you know, their mind.
Right. And, you know, we have women that, you know, they get a police record very young, and it's very difficult to find employment to make a living. They could get a job flipping burgers at McDonald's, but that's not going to do it. And so they feel like, you know, we had a girl that we worked with for years who, it was at a strip club. She had a record. She did not have driver's license. She drove a moped, even in the rain, in the sleet, in the snow. It didn't matter. She never missed a night shift, because that was really her only option at the time. And that is heartbreaking. That is heartbreaking when she's like, I could find probably a job, but then I may not have transportation to get there, and then I'll get fired. Like, they start building this whole mountain of obstacles. Some of them are legitimate, some of them aren't, some of them are in their head, because people just beat them down so much. And they've been beaten down so much. And chances are, if they have a boyfriend that is still allowing them to do this, or a husband, we've had so many instances of women being trafficked by their husband. That's a whole nother animal.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's very common, believe it or not. So if they don't even have that support system at home that encourages them and it supports them in this lifestyle, what husband or boyfriend could support the person they supposedly love doing this, right? I mean, but most of them have boyfriends or significant others or husbands. That's common. Not as many are single as you would think. So it's you know, you really got to get to the trauma. You've got to get to what happened to get them there, before you can even suggest things or encourage them, because you don't know. I mean, we had a girl that we met a few years ago in a strip club. And oh my goodness, the first time we met her, she's a woman, like she's actually an older woman, believe it or not, in this industry. She was actually very mean to us. Like, she was absolutely mean. Just matter of fact, our chaplain, she was like, I just want to wash her mouth out with soap. I mean, she was just really mean. So, hang on a second. Sorry about that.
You're okay.
So we just kept, every time we would go visit, we would still say hello to her. We would still be nice to her, but she really wanted nothing to do with us. 2 years later, she tells us now, please don't wait too long to come back. I need to see you. Please don't wait too long to come back. But her grandfather was a pastor and was a pedophile, and she was one of the victims, and everybody supported her grandfather. So with us coming in, even though we don't wear this banner of we're all Christians, we're coming in, like, they know. I mean, we just kind of breathe light when we come in, right? So without us saying anything, they know. So immediately when she first met us, she thought, oh, here comes those kind of people again. Here come those people that supported my grandfather and who loved him and are hypocrites because they knew what he was doing. So now that we know what she went through, we have a much better way, a understanding of how to approach her, right? We can't really, it's going to have to be relationship built. And she's really searching and she's, you know, she'll ask questions and things because she's like, if I walked in the church, it would catch on fire. And I said, well, you know what? You could come to church with me and I would walk in, and if you catch on fire, so would I. we'll just go down the flames together, girl. How's that? So you really have to kind of have that lighthearted approach like that to her. And we just have to continue to love on her and let her come to us. You know, God will do that part. If we're just there when she needs us, he'll do his part. So we just have to be patient and be consistent.
Now, what does that look like whenever you go in? How did you develop a strategy in a sense of how to talk to victims? And what is maybe those tools look like and how you train your staff? Because I think that's something, that's an important tool. Like you said, a lot of people are very uncomfortable with this topic. And a lot of survivors are coming out and talking, and it's not out of, perspective for me to think that even if there's people out there that have never met a survivor in their life or somebody that they know is going through something, they will, you know, and I think that's always hard whenever you're not, you know, it can catch somebody off guard and kind of ruin any type of connection or way to have an impact if you don't know how to talk to somebody who's right in front of you going through something. So I'd love to hear maybe kind of some things that you've learned or what approach do you take, especially because these are people that, you know, are going through something hard, most likely. So what does that look like for you guys whenever you walk in to these places?
It's really kind of interesting. As a matter of fact, when we walk into a new place, I had a girl with us that was fairly new. And she said, what are we going to say? And I said, I have no idea. I have no idea what we're going to say because we don't know what the environment's going to be. We just go in and we introduce ourselves. We just introduce ourselves. And if there is something that we can think of, and this is part of our training, that's very valuable, is if we go in somewhere and we can think of anything to strike up a conversation with a girl without just saying, hi, I'm Tracy. What is your name? I mean, you can do that, certainly. But like the new girl, when I went, is that your name because you're tall? Like, I really want to make it about them. I want to make a conversation about them. I'll go in and we'll comment on somebody's hair. I'll go, your hair is really, really pretty. You know, there was one girl that I used to tell her I was going to have her teach me how to do my makeup because her makeup was always like perfect. So you really kind of try to make it about them to begin with, like right off the bat, you make it about them. But I would tell anybody, if you ever suspect anything, if you look somebody in the eyes and you just, all you have to say is, are you okay? That will either break down a barrier or they will go, sure, they'll put on the face and go, yeah, I'm good. And the only thing you can say at that point is, if you're ever not okay, know that you can come to me. Know that you can come talk to me if you're ever not okay. And you know what I mean. And that is a really, really simple way to do that. There's a lady I know who, a coworker of hers, she has been in some pornography. Her husband is involved in that somehow. And it got out on social media. So her workplace asked her to please stop. And I said, and she said she won't stop. I said, the thing you need to understand is she may not have a choice. If her husband is involved in this, she may not have a choice to stop. I don't care if she puts on a happy face and says, oh, it's nothing. That's what they're trained to do. That's what they're told to do. That's their self-guard to say, it's okay. My husband knows. We're good. We're making money. I said, but please understand that she may not be in a position to stop. It may not be her choice to stop. And I said, and that's what I gave her. The advice I gave her is just get her. She knows you. You work together. Just ask her, are you okay? And give her that option. Leave that door open that if she's not okay, that she can come to you and have that conversation and know that it's a safe place. And yet people, I almost guarantee you that pretty much everybody knows somebody that has either been attempted to be groomed or been involved somehow. You just don't know. It is that widespread that I don't know anybody who doesn't know somebody. You just may not be aware of that. And you have to keep your eyes open. You have to look for those out of character changes in personality. It's just like sex houses, brothels. They're in every neighborhood, fluent neighborhoods. They're not in the ghetto. They're not in, that's not where they are. You know, my neighborhood has over 300 houses, and I would be very shocked if there's not one in my neighborhood. You know, they will rent a house and set those up. Be aware of what's around you. You know what your neighbors drive. You know what kind of cars they drive. You know that they don't leave at 3 a.m. and all different cars coming all day and night. You know that. That's not typical of a residential house. You have to pay attention. And then you have to, don't ever try to intervene yourself. But certainly call the police and go, can we get a well check on a house? Here's what I'm suspecting. This is what I'm seeing. Can you do a well check on that house and just make sure? And the police, if they've been trained, most police at this point have been trained to spot trafficking. I know here it's really good. The training's very, very good here. But they'll go to that house and go, and they'll pretend they got the wrong house. They know what to do to get enough of a look to see what they think's going on. So you can always ask for a well check at a house, or, if you're at the nail salon and you suspect something, you can ask for a well check. You can call the non-emergency number and do that and ask for a well check. If there's nothing wrong, what does it hurt? Right?
100%. What other things, in your opinion, have you seen that maybe are not so obvious to other people who don't know that this is happening? How do you view the world differently? And what are maybe some things that you could recommend people look out for, whether they're in a business or an establishment or just, in their neighborhoods and communities?
One of the things that happened to me, actually, when I first got started, I was in the nail salon and I was getting a pedicure, and there was a young girl across the room getting her nails done. And she may have been 16-ish, 15-ish. And there was a man sitting with her that was probably, I'm going to say, early 50s. And the conversation and the dynamic between them was not like daughter-father dynamic. And I sat and watched, and I couldn't hear the conversation, but I could see kind of the body language between them. And I sat there and watched, and she very much wanted his approval of like the nail color she picked out. She very much, what teenager cares that their dad likes their nail color, first of all? But he never left her side. That was not a conversation. It just wasn't body language between like a girl and her dad body language. And I watched them when they left, and they didn't pay. They didn't check out at the desk like everybody else does. And when I asked about it to some people that work in this, and they're like, well, the pimp probably has a tab there. The trafficker probably has a tab there. And that was just as simple as me watching. I was getting a pedicure, so I was just sitting and watching. And just the dynamic between them was not daughter-father. He never left her side, not for a minute, to get her nails done. Usually if dad's going to sit up front, or he's going to go do something and come back and pick her up, he's not going to sit right next to her getting her nails done and watch every move they make. That just seemed really weird to me. So just being observant, just paying attention to what's going on around you. And, you know, get educated, tell other people. It is not the white van that drives around collecting people. You know how many people would be on milk cartons if all people involved in trafficking were kidnapped? Most of it happens right in front of you in the high schools. The high school students recruit each other. They are used to recruit other high school students without even really knowing, or something's being held over them. If you don't do this, your little sister will. I'll go get your little elementary school sister. Or it would be a shame if your dad's brakes failed on his car. And when you're 16, everything somebody says is world ending, right? So it really is all around. And the only way that we can tackle it is education. That, you know, I'll speak to youth groups with their parents in attendance. And I kind of tell the youth, I'll go, this is a safe space. Pretend your parents aren't here. Raise your hand if on an app on your phone, at school, at the mall, on a game you play, how many of you have been approached by somebody you don't know asking personal questions? And over half will raise their hand. The other half are just scared to raise their hand. But they will raise their hand. And, you know, you have to explain to them, that person really doesn't care what you made on your science test. That person doesn't care if you won your football game. They don't care. You know, they don't care about the new piece of music you're learning on the piano. They really don't care. They don't know you. They're asking these personal questions to use that information against you later. So education is critical. And that really is educating society on how to spot it. And educating youth on how to understand that the people that they're coming in contact with aren't really trying to befriend them. So education is critical, and we actually created a comic book. We had a writer she's out of London, and the illustrator's out of Tennessee, and the publisher. And it's for that tween age group. It's like kind of a 9 to 12. And it helps parents. It's all comic book, and it helps the parents and the kids understand kind of what that grooming looks like. These are middle school students who are playing a video game and they start getting groomed. So it's a really good read for the parents and kids to start having that conversation together. Parents don't understand, how do I start this conversation with my child, which I may not have even had the talk with yet. And I'm like, well, you will, or somebody online will.
Right.
I mean, somebody will have the talk.
And a lot of parents don't even know a lot about it. Like, that book, I'm sure, is even helpful for parents to understand it from a child's perspective.
Well, it's just so easy. I mean, kids are so vulnerable. Teenagers, they want to be accepted. That's every teenager's dream, is to be accepted somewhere. And these groomers, they train on who they can groom. There is a video that we watched in training, and it was a perpetrator who was in prison for grooming. He worked for a trafficker, and he said he could be at the mall and he could walk up to a girl or a boy, because boys are susceptible as well. And he said, within 30 seconds, I could tell if I could have them or not. It would take me 30 seconds to know if this is a person that I could groom or not. If not, I'd move on. We were told by law enforcement that these groomers, they study Hitler's manipulation tactics. That's how serious they are at grooming. And we have to be as serious at education. And I think, you know, the misconception, Hollywood's not done trafficking any favors.
No,
because the movies all are the white van, coming around, kidnapping. Truly, a trafficking victim is going to go to school. They're going to come home. They're going to pretend to go to their friend's house. They're going to go to a motel, do what they're supposed to do. They're going to get dropped back off at home, and the parents aren't going to know anything. That's what trafficking really looks like for youth. For adults, husbands traffic wives. We've had it more than once. People just think that it's this white van and it could never happen to me, or it could never happen to my child. And it absolutely could. So education and people understanding what trafficking really, really looks like is critical at putting a dent in it. We can't chase down every bad guy. We'll never do that. You know, we would love to create a workshop for men. We would love to create a workshop for men and teenage boys coming with their dads to understand that magazine you're looking at, those videos, it's not just, oh, it's boys being boys. That person that looks so happy, like they're enjoying that, they're being forced to do that. They're being drugged to do that. What you're seeing is not what you're perceiving. And I think, you know, I think it's critical for boys to understand that porn leads to trafficking. It's all an addiction, just like drugs. One thing you start with, you get desensitized, you got to go to something harder. It's just like a drug until you want to act it out. And then it has to go to trafficking. You got to pay somebody to act it out. So we really would like to attack it from the men and boys side and have that presented by men, no women in the room, so they could have frank conversations. So the dads and their teenage sons, and they can have these frank conversations about what you're really seeing. What is, you know, really, let's humanize it. Let's humanize it from a young age where once they understand what it is, it's actually repulsive instead of intriguing. So those are just, you know, some of the ways that we would like to tackle things in the future.
Oh, that just got me so excited. That's been a topic that's been on my mind for a while. And I'm so surprised that more people aren't talking about that aspect. You know, I watched this little documentary. I wish I could remember what it was called. It was like 30 minutes long, but it talked about from a neurological perspective, yeah, what happens to a child at a young age when they stumble upon this, yeah, and even how later on in life that can lead a child that was born into a good family, wasn't abused, into being a pedophile potentially. Yeah. 'Cause like you said, it's like one high, they're chasing one high after another. And after a while, one of them doesn't satisfy. So they have to keep, you know, going for something harder. And right, it's fine, because what is it? The average age a child sees pornography now is, you know, 7, 8 years old. Yeah. And
it's young.
Oh my gosh. And doing the work that you do, I bet a lot of the, you know, entertainers, performers, you know, they have no idea. Like they're thinking that their target audience even is adults and not realizing, yeah, that what they're doing is, you know, feeding children access to this.
Right. Right. And they just don't, they're looking on their end. If they're doing it by choice, they're looking for the money. Of course, yeah, if they're being forced to do it, you know, they it's kind of a self-protection thing to go, oh, well, men just see this. Because honestly, any person with a conscience that would think, what happens if a 9-year-old boy is watching this? How would I feel if a 9-year-old boy, it's different if a 25-year-old's watching me. What if a 9-year-old boy is watching me? Right? So there's so many ways that this needs to be tackled, and from so many angles. It's, you know, we need to work on the demand side just as well as we have to work on the supply side.
Yes.
We have to, without demand, there wouldn't be no need for the supply, right?
Yes. And like you were saying, people that do consume, you know, these movies and videos and go to strip clubs, like you said, if they knew that what they're watching on Pornhub is a girl being raped.
That's right.
Fully. And yes, that, like you said, she's being drugged. She's being dragged off into another room to have it done all over again right after, right, that. we'd be horrified. Like these men would be horrified realizing what they're getting excited about, you know? And it's horrifying just how proliferated and normalized this has become in society. It's really scary to me.
It really is. And the scary thing is, and it makes our job much more important. And, you know, I encourage people, if you feel like you have a calling for this and there's not an organization in your area that is really hitting the ground. I don't mean just an organization, but I mean one that's really hitting the ground like we are. Like, you know, I mean, we're in it. We're there. We're in, you know, we walk on the turf. We go in the buildings. We educate as much as we can educate. We'll go speak to anybody. It really is as simple. You don't even have to have a nonprofit. It really is as simple as having a couple of people together that have this like mission and go, we're going to go do this. Like we're going to educate. We're going to get educated ourselves. And we're going to go educate people. If it's my kids' soccer team and parents, if it's my kids' football team and parents, if it's my daughter's dance class and parents, I don't care how small the group is. I've been asked to come to a house to speak to a group of teenage girls before and their parents. I'm good with that. During COVID, we did an online Zoom for Girl Scouts. I'm good with that. Like, I'll talk to anybody who'll listen. And, you know, our information that we have, we are willing to share with anybody. So if somebody's like, I don't really want to have to dig, I don't really know what I'm looking for, but I would love to talk to, you know, start talking to groups. I have a connection to groups. I would love to start educating them. Then we are certainly willing to give them what we have and encourage them to do research themselves to do that. You can't be, I mean, it's not wrong. You can't be wrong. It's there. If you know the way, if you know how to recognize that and you can communicate that and what it really looks like, then you can't be wrong. It's open those discussions. I mean, when I did the Zoom with the Girl Scouts during COVID, you know, they were on there with their moms. Of course, the girls and their moms were all on, and we had like probably 20 girls on there. And do you know, three of them had stories of trying to get people, somebody trying to groom them. And their moms knew about it. So they were, and I said, we're going to have a discussion. I'm not going to spew facts at you. Like I really, you know, all of my education is interactive. I really want questions. I really want discussion. I can throw facts at you all day and statistics all day long. And it really doesn't mean anything. Right. So I really like to be interactive with people and ask those questions. And do you know, we've spoken at places and a woman come out and go, my husband always tried, my ex-husband tried to traffic me all the time. And I never knew that's what it really was. Like, I never knew. I knew he was abusive, but I didn't realize that's what he was trying to do until I heard you speak. So wow. I think parents would be very, very surprised at how many of their children and teenagers have been approached. And the teenagers may, and the kids may not even realize that's what it was until they start hearing what it looks like. And the parents, I think, they're usually very shocked because they're like, my child? Really? Like, we monitor everything with my child. No, you don't. They're always a step ahead of you. Yeah. The kids are always a step ahead of you. The traffickers are always three steps ahead of you. So, you know, speak to anybody and everybody. If you, like I said, if somebody feels called and they don't have an organization near them that is hitting the ground, do it. Do it. You don't even have to be a nonprofit. You can just be a group of people. If somebody in their church wants to start a ministry to do that, absolutely. Ours started out of our church with four people years ago. And then it just kind of snowballed and we felt like it was too much for our church to try to manage everything we needed to do. So we formed the nonprofit, which was the right thing to do. But certainly it's as simple as a couple of people getting together and going, what can we do? And if it's nothing but printing some postcards and going all over town, handing out postcards and going, do you know it's here? so you know trafficking is here. And you can actually put websites on there like Homeland Security has a website. You know, Homeland Security is very involved and they have so much information. So even if you don't have a website, even if you aren't organized to that point, you can put that information on a postcard. And you can, you know, you can get a group of people walking all over town, walking around shops going, can I put this stack of postcards in your shop? You know, it's really as simple as things like that. We have some little 2x2 little cards that talk about trafficking. They're little tiny cards. And on the back, it has the human trafficking hotline. And most of the time, somebody in a trafficking situation, a bathroom stall is the only place that they are alone. So we'll go in the malls, into gas stations, truck stops, and we'll go in the bathrooms and we'll go in the stalls and we'll stick them in the stalls. That's something that a girl could put in her bra. I mean, just as simple as those things. There's no danger involved. You just got a group of people that's going to say, we're going to cover this strip of road and we're going to go in all the bathrooms of the restaurants, the bars, the hotels, the gas stations, the rest stops, truck stops. And we're going to go and we're going to stick these little cards in every stop. I mean, there's just so many ways that you can get involved without having to have a nonprofit, without really feeling like, you know, that you need to spend your time organizing an organization. There's just so many things you can do.
I love that. We always say that too on our podcast. You know, it can be just even as simple as like sharing something on your social media, you know, something that you're already doing, you're already posting, you're already on there. Sure. And it doesn't have to even be something that you make, like go steal somebody else's something and, you know, put it on your page and just say, hey, did you know this? You know, I think the concept of just learning is so overwhelming for people. That it seems like such a big problem and people feel like I'm just one person. I don't know what to do. And even if I did, I'm not going to make a difference. Not realizing that if everybody just think about if the whole world did one social media post, it would make a huge difference. Everybody would see something, you know, like something like that would make such a difference. If every single bathroom had that sticker on it.
Yeah.
If all airports did, you know, all these places that, you know, could possibly be trafficking hubs. It's like, that could make a huge difference, those little things.
Right. And you don't really have to have a lot of education. It's not overwhelming. Again, the Homeland Security website has free, they will send, there's pamphlets. There's little cards that fit in your wallet. There's little keychain fobs. There's all kinds of things that they'll send you for free. You can just order a batch of all types of different pamphlets about trafficking. All types of brochures about trafficking. You can order all of that off the Homeland Security website and they will just send it to you at no charge. So those are things you can take around and pass out. Those are things you can use. And you don't, there's no cost to you at all to have to make something or have something printed. And they're, you know, they have some great stuff on there. We use it sometimes too.
That's awesome. And that's such good advice for people listening. Now, for you guys, when you are doing these talks in these facilities, or say somebody contacts you and they're ready to get out, you've built the relationship, or maybe it's right away. Maybe they've already been thinking about it and you were that source that helped, you know, that was there for them to say, well, I can help you with that. What does that look like when you're trying to get somebody out of this? And has that been dangerous? Is that something that, you know, what does that look like?
It's a little more dangerous for children.
Okay.
Because you're actually taking a child back and we don't do that. There's other organizations here that do that very well. When somebody has either left or is thinking about leaving, no matter if it's trafficking, no matter if it's the sex industry, we kind of treat them all the same, even though every case is very different. Our first concern is, do they have a safe place to stay? And are they healthy? Do we need to get medical attention? And are they going to be safe? Do they have a person? Believe it or not, there's not a lot of safe houses for them. That's one of the things we would love to do in the future. There's not a lot. We would like to do a temporary, short-term, immediate thing. There's not a lot of that, especially if they have children. most homes, most of these places won't take them with children, which is a problem because we, most of our women that we deal with have children. So we want to know if they're healthy and safe. Once we get those two things conquered, then we're going to start writing a success plan. What does that short term look like? What do we need to do short term? What are the immediate things that we need to handle? And then let's do maybe a 3-month. What's going to be that next plan? And then a very long-term plan. Like, where do we want to be in a year? Let's start writing that out. We actually write it out. That's homework they have. Let's start thinking about that. Let's start writing out what we need to do to be successful to stay out of that, right? Sometimes they need to go away. We need to find them a home. I mean, they need to get out of their environment. They need to get away from where their trafficker or their pimp or their, it's all the same difference. Their influencers are. They need to get away from that. So we have contacts throughout the country that we could call and go, do you have a bed? Do you have, you know? So sometimes it's the next city over. We'll call them. We have relationships with other organizations and say, do you have placement for this person? Sometimes it takes that. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes they have friends or family that would be safe that they could stay with. Sometimes those relationships are a little rocky, but they're also happy they're out. Usually that can be bridged pretty well. So we really want to help them walk that success plan. We want to hold them accountable. We want to have those mentor meetings and go, okay, this week, you were supposed to do X and X. Did you get that done? Because next week we have to do X, right? So we kind of keep them accountable. We keep them encouraged. And the further they get down that success plan, the more confidence they get in themselves. We have to have the confidence for them in the beginning because they're scared. And honestly, as bad as that life is, it's still better than the unknown.
Yes.
Right? So we really want to step-by-step walk them through that success plan. And the further they get through that, the more confidence they get in themselves, the more things they accomplish, the more confidence they get. And so that's really kind of our approach to that. And we put it on them. Now it's going to be on them to do the work. We can't do that for you. We will hold your hand. We will encourage you. If there's a resource that we need to connect you with to make something happen, we will certainly do that. We'll get you all the resources you need. The only person that can make you fail is you, because we're going to give you everything you're going to need to complete that success plan and get where you want to be. So that's really our approach with a survivor that's leaving.
I think that's really a gentle and graceful approach, because I know there are organizations that will kind of rip somebody out, almost like, you know, rescuing a child. They'll kind of just take them out and then throw them out to the wind and say, all right, you're out of there. Go live your life. You're free. And it's not always that easy. And I think the statistic is a survivor, or I should say a victim at this point, a lot of times will go back 7-8 times before they actually leave.
Absolutely.
So I love that you guys do just a gradual approach. It's not just this one and done thing where you just, you know, it's expected to happen right away. I think that that's the best way to build confidence and trust, because I think a lot of times when you do just rip somebody out of everything that's familiar to them, now it's so foreign. It's almost like taking somebody that's not in that environment and just throwing them in and being like, here's your new life. And it's like, wait a minute, I'm in a strip club. Like, what, you know, that environment is just as foreign to us as our environment can be for somebody like them.
Well, you think about this, think about if you just moved to a different country. I mean, because this is the same concept. Say you moved to Zimbabwe tomorrow, okay? And all of a sudden, you're supposed to completely, on a moment's notice, navigate. How do you find a place to live? How do you find a place to work? How do you find a doctor? How do you find a bank? How do you get a bank account? How do you, like, you know how it works here. You don't know how it works there. And what if you're just left there by yourself and you don't know anybody? You don't speak the language. It is the same concept. If somebody just if you can't do that, being educated, computer savvy, if you can't figure that out and nobody's there to walk you through how to do that, what are the chances that you're just going to come back? Right? You're just going to give up. No matter how bad you want to be there, you're going to give up and come back. It's the same concept. Is if you don't help them write a success plan that makes sense to them, that they can see actually truly working, what is the incentive for them to try? A lot of them don't even know how to use a computer. And in this day and age, you can't even work at McDonald's if you don't understand a computer. Right?
Right.
So there's just so many hurdles that we need to connect them with resources, or we need to provide resources. There's just, and as long as we can go, as long as every time they bring up an obstacle, we go, well, we have a resource for that. We can fix that. Then they're just like, oh, okay, next. They can see that path coming to fruition. But if they're thrown out here, and some of these have been trafficked since they were young, and some of these have been in this industry since they were young, they've never been taught to use a computer. They don't have a high school education. They wouldn't know where to even start to look for a job.
They might not have a phone that's theirs that could be owned by whoever their pimp or abuser is too, you know?
They normally will not. I mean, they're going to be very limited. You know, we had a survivor one time that spoke and said, if you're helping a survivor, do not ever ask us where we want to eat. Do not ever ask us what our favorite thing to do is. Don't ever ask us anything that involves choice, because we don't know. I couldn't tell you my favorite food. I've just always eaten what's been given. It's all about choice for them. They've never had choice. And so they don't know what they like to do. You're drugged all day to sleep. You're drugged to stay awake all night and work. You're moved from motel to motel or house to house. You're given what little bit of food to keep you alive. And it's whatever they want you to have. It could be a can of pork and beans. I mean, whatever they give you is what you have. So, you know, they don't have choices. They don't know. And it's almost like taking a kid to a candy store, right? You cannot, you just have to take a kid and go, you can have this, this, or this. Because if they see the whole candy store, they get freaked out. They have no idea what to do in an entire candy store. It's kind of the same thing. They get so overwhelmed and they'll just shut down and give up. And they go back to what they know. It's easier, right? So, you know, you just have to be very, very careful. And we make sure that the resources we give them are resources that are going to help them get over the next hurdle. There's going to be multiple, sometimes many. So you really want to help them see that hope. And like I said, the further they get into that and away from that life, the further they get away, the more confidence they have. But you got to hold their hand. They're not going to stay out by themselves.
And honestly, I think that's good advice just in general. That's the same, you know, if we are aware that somebody in our life or somebody that we know somehow or associated with is going through something potentially really dangerous or abusive, it's kind of the same. Like you said, you can't just walk in guns a-blazing like, oh, I'm going to take you out and rescue. Like, I'm here, superhero. You know, you have to be very gentle with that. And it really does have to be, you know, on their terms when that happens, whether it's a timeline or just confidence, like you said, resources. There's a lot more that goes into this than I think people realize, especially, you know, in places like strip clubs. Like,
yes,
we just as a society think, well, they have money, they have all this stuff, they're connected with people. And it's like, they have their, you know, somebody by every string on their body. Like they yes, have no control over anything, their finances, they're handled basically.
Right. You know? Right. It is. And, you know, we have a girl that left the brothel probably about 4 months ago, and she has two little boys, and we work with her. And so last year for Christmas, her 2-year-old, well, he's two now, he's almost three, Because she didn't have money for Christmas, she took some of his old toys and wrapped them so he would have something to unwrap. Mm-hmm. And again, it's no choice. It's no choice. And now, this week, we are taking her Christmas shopping. We could easily just go buy toys for her children for Christmas. We could easily do that. But it's about choice. It's about taking her, giving her a budget, her child, and letting her pick her own children's Christmas gifts out and taking them home and wrapping them herself. It's some ownership, right? It's choices. It's, you know, it's her getting to feel some independence and some choice. And, you know, our hope is that someday, because she has so much potential, this girl has so much potential. Our hope is that someday she'll be in a position that she could take another woman like that shopping so they could have a choice, you know, and she could pay for it. And that's what, you know, and she'll text us that back. And she's like, oh, someday I hope I can return the favor to somebody else. Right. But we encourage her all the time. You know, we took her out to dinner after she left for a celebration dinner. Aww. Our team did. We took her out to dinner and I'm going to tell you, the amazing thing was, is we had gotten her because we knew she'd gotten a job, a legitimate job. But, you know, it takes a couple of weeks to start getting a paycheck. It takes a little bit. So we had gotten her a substantial grocery gift card and a substantial gas gift card to kind of help bridge that. So she didn't feel like she had to go back and work a night or two at the club or anything like that until she started getting a paycheck. Right. So we take her out to dinner and we give her the cards. And on the envelopes was her real name, not her stage name. It was her real name. And so during dinner, we're just all talking. And so I hand her the gift cards. And they're in some encouraging cards we all signed. And she looked on the card and she just started crying. And we're like, what's the matter? And she said, I really thought you wouldn't use my real name. She said, you actually used my real name. We're like, yeah, that other person isn't you. Ugh. That other person isn't you. And we know you. And so she just broke down and just really started crying because we actually used her real name. And, you know, by the time dinner was over, we had heard her whole testimony of being a teenager in rehab. And we just, her testimony is fantastic. And I said, you do understand that now that you're on this side, eventually you're going to have to tell somebody that, because somebody needs to hear that. That it all didn't happen for no reason. Right. I'm like, so just be prepared at some point that you're going to have to tell that story, because somebody's going to need to hear it and you won't know who that is, you know? So she just, you know, she's just in a really good place right now. And we're just going to continue to encourage her and support her. And, you know, we're going to just walk her through.
That's so powerful. That brought a tear to my eye too. It's like, oh no, I'm going to cry. I think that's amazing that you guys take so much time to make these experiences personal. And like you said, it's not this pushy thing. It's not forceful. You're not pushing, you know, religious beliefs and things like that. You're just letting people come into their own and really just showing somebody who they are instead of right. who they've been groomed to be or forced to be, you know, right. And I think that that's just beautiful. What are you guys doing now? I heard some exciting news. John had said you guys are looking to expand and stuff. I'd love for you to talk about what's next for you guys, because this sounds really exciting.
Sure. We are looking to expand our field team, first of all, which is a rarity. We don't do that often, but we are feeling led. We don't really, we're kind of praying about it. We don't really have a candidate necessarily really in mind. God kind of puts those people in place. But we just started, it's really kind of a findings team committee about possibly opening the Ruby Center, which would be part resource center for women that we encounter, that we work with, that would have a computer lab. We would have classes for them, like financial classes and budgeting. We would have self-care classes. We would have yoga classes for them. You know, those kind of things are just excellent therapeutic means of dealing with some things. So we want to have a center where they can come at no charge and just really, you know, if they need to learn how to write a resume, they need a computer to take classes. They need some tutoring even because they're getting a GED, or we just want to provide, you know, resources for them to help them when they need that hand up. We're not doing the handout. We won't give them anything, but we will give them a hand up. If they need practice before a job interview, we'll set up and do a fake job interview for them. Just all types of things to prepare them to be successful outside of that lifestyle. But we also, in turn, want to have at least one emergency room. Our goal would, it would be maybe like a 3-4 bedroom house. So the master bedroom and bathroom would really be an emergency short-term situation for women, even if they have children up to the age of 10, until we can find them permanent placement, or until they, you know, they may have family in another state that they can stay with, but they've got to arrange that. If we're trying to find them safe housing in another state or another area, I mean, and that would be good for up to 90 days where, and in the meantime, we would help provide them resources if they need it. They can also use the resource center. So that really is kind of our next dream thought. We'll see if God opens that door. We have a committee that met for the first time just to come back with findings of what we need to do, what that budget's going to look like. So, you know, we're praying about that, and we'll see where that goes, and it'll come when it's supposed to come, but it is much needed in this area. Well, it's much needed in every area, honestly. The shortage of, you know, if somebody walked, I mean, and I explained to that committee, I was like, none of you really have been in the field, so you don't really understand that urgency of going into a brothel and you're outside talking to a girl and she says, my boyfriend stabbed me. I'm homeless. I don't want to be here. And I'm helpless because I have nowhere to take her immediately. Right. So I'm sitting there literally helpless is what I feel. So those are the situations that I'm like, unless you've been in that situation, you really don't understand the urgency. And you know, some of them were asking, well, how often do you think it would be used? And I said, you've got to understand, when other agencies in our state know that we have a room and that we accept children, we will be getting phone calls all the time going, is that room available?
Oh, yeah.
We'll drive 2 hours. Is that room available? I said, it would be in use, I would think, probably most all the time. Even if it wasn't somebody we were directly serving. I think other agencies anywhere in our state that knew we had that room, you know, we were looking at like a full bed and then bunk beds and then have like a pack and play if they have a baby. And they would have their own bathroom as the master. That would be our goal. And I think it would be full most all the time.
I do too, especially if, like you said, in your area, there's, and I think that's in general, I don't think safe houses are as prevalent as they need to be. You know,
no.
There's definitely more support for, you know, homeless shelters and stuff in cities. And even those are so overcrowded. There's not an abundance of help for, you know, survivors of trafficking and just these industries that want to get out. So I love that you're providing, again, a solution to something that really touched you in your heart that had to have been a really horrible feeling. Just being like, gosh, I wish I had somewhere for you and
right.
I don't, you know, and I think that's really special that you're going to build that. And I have no doubt that you will. And what about if people are listening and they're like, oh, I live in her area, or I would love to get involved with something like that. Where can people maybe get in touch with you? Or maybe they want to, or have a resource for you for, you know, what you have coming. How can people get in touch with you guys?
They can contact me directly. And that's director@therubyorg.org. They can also contact me through the site. And our website is therubyorg.org. So there's contact information in there that will directly come to me. And they can email That's usually the best way to contact us because we don't have a facility right now. But really, I know a lot of people are like, well, I don't have money. I don't have this. How can I help? I've never met anybody that didn't have some kind of connection or some kind of resource that couldn't be helpful. They just don't know that. They just might not understand that the need is broad and the need is wide. And people are like, I certainly couldn't do that. Well, then there's a lot of other things that you could do. And if it's making phone calls, there's a lot of things that could be done for people who don't feel like they're equipped or called to be frontline in the field. Not everybody is. This is not for everybody. And that's for sure. It really is not for everybody. You can't take all that home with you. You've got to be able to compartmentalize that a little bit. And we do what we can do for them, but you can't take it home and lay awake at night because you can't. It just takes a certain personality to do that. But there's so many other ways to help. If you're in our area, certainly we would love to help. And again, if you're in your area, find an organization. If there's not one, get a group together. There's a million things you can do. Nobody's helpless in this. That's for sure.
What about going off of that? If somebody is watching this or just has it in their heart and they're like, oh, I don't live where she does, but I really want to get involved. I'm going to start looking in my area. What should people look for? Because not every organization is created equal to you. Do you have advice for people, maybe questions to ask, or maybe a little checklist of what to maybe look for in some organizations to make sure they're a good fit?
Typically, your smaller organizations are more grassroots. They're going to be on the ground usually. Large organizations and I'm not saying that a lot of them don't do good work, because there are some that do fantastic work. From an organization that's strictly volunteers, organizations that are spending millions for CEOs and things like that. When I'm just like, if we had 2 million, the Ruby Center would be up and right.
And that's some salary in another organization,
Right. Exactly. So really look into what are they doing? Like they can be a 501c3. Anybody can be a 501c3. All you do is apply for the paperwork. But really look into what they're doing. What are their teams doing? How often are they out in the community? How often are they out in the field? Are they educating? Because I think if you're not educating along with everything else, you're missing the point. And just really look carefully at how active they are and what they're doing and how they're using their money. Look and see how they're doing that. If our organization had multi-million dollars, we would have more than one Ruby Center. We would have multiples, and we would be helping a lot of people. So really look at how they're using their money. Are there volunteers? And I'm not saying that full-time directors shouldn't get paid. If I were full-time, I have a full-time job. But if I were the full-time director of the Ruby Center and that was my full-time job, I would expect compensation for that. But it needs to be reasonable compensation. And I'm very mission minded. So it's one of those deals where I feel like the money should be in the mission. If you got the money, we should be pouring it into the mission itself. So really look at those things. There are some great organizations out there. There really are.
Right. It's just, they're smaller, so they don't get as much press, or they don't get acknowledged as much. And I think some people think their only option is those big ones. And I think it's really special too to support those small grassroots. They're the ones that, like you said, they're the ones actually doing the work and most likely not taking anything home for it. It's just right from the goodness of their hearts. Do you have a donation? Can people donate to you if they want, is what I'm trying to ask?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. There is a link on our website.
Okay.
For reoccurring or one-time donations. And they can find that, of course, at therubyorg.org.
Okay. And is there anything else that you'd like to add to this before we kind of close this up, Tracy? Or anything that you want people to know?
Just be aware. Just keep your eyes open. If something looks weird, it probably is. I mean, really, pay attention. And that's really the biggest key to any of it, is paying attention, because it's all around you every day. And if you get in that comfort bubble of saying, as long as I don't let my child go to the mall, or as long as I don't, I mean, I have people all the time that are like, that's why I don't let my child go to the mall. But you let them on the video games. They have a phone with apps. They know how to hide the apps. They are so far ahead of you. You know, be aware of what trafficking really, really looks like. If there is a seminar in your area to educate you on trafficking, go to it. Go attend it. Like, learn what it really is. It's not a white van driving around picking up your children. That is not what trafficking is.
That's such a good point. Kids are always taught stranger danger. And I think to an extent, unconsciously, that's what we think of as adults, especially because, like you said, if you don't have some type of a firsthand experience, whether it's yourself or you know somebody that went through it, you do just think it's like that movie Taken from Hollywood, where it's just this random violent event, a stranger kidnaps somebody in a van and, you know, holds them hostage. And it's like, yeah, that happens. But the percentage of that compared to the
very small.
Most of the time, the person knows their trafficker. They've known them. They've been groomed, and that's how it happens.
They trust them.
Yeah. It's not some violent event. So I love that you're educating on that part too, because that's something very, I wasn't taught that growing up. I was taught stranger danger too.
You know, I mean, it's like the girl that I know that said the other night, the guy walked up to her and he was in dress slacks and a button down shirt and a Lexus. You would not pick him out and go, that's a criminal.
Yes.
That's a stalker. That's a groomer. That's not what you would say. You would say, that's a wealthy businessman. He's driving a Lexus. He's in nice business clothes. He's groomed really well. You know, he's going to come as Prince Charming. He's not going to come as the Grinch. He's coming as Prince Charming. Right? And so, kids, you know, they did the study where the kids, they showed this really scary looking man, and then they showed this really nice looking man, and they asked the kids which one the bad man was. And they always picked the ugly, scary looking guy. And that is just, we have got to get out of that. The groomers are coming looking like Prince Charming. They are charming. They're good looking. They're going to offer you the world. They have nice cars. They have nice things. They are not coming as the gang member down the street. They're not coming as the big bad monster. That's not who they're coming as. And we've just got to re-educate society on what that really looks like.
1,000,000%. There was somebody that I did an interview with pretty recently. His name is Remy Adeleke, and he made a movie about organ harvesting. He's an independent filmmaker. And that, when I was talking to him, one of the things that he said was, the most important thing in my film was to make sure that the trafficking was happening on a private jet, because people don't realize that that's the main demographic that is trafficking in any type of way. It's not the scum on the street. It is the people in the nice cars and the private jets who are wearing a suit, you know? And that's so important, because we're taught to respect the person in the suit, to idolize the person with the nice car, and to not ask any questions. But if you see somebody on the street that looks kind of funny or dirty, those are the people we like to target, when really, like, those are the unresourceful people that probably can't even, you know, figure out how to, you know, get an ID. They're not the ones trafficking people, at least most of the time. It is the people that have all the resources, have all the money to do it, all the connections, all the transportation, all the different ways to do it. They're the most resourceful people, which is really scary. Yeah.
Well, they have, you know, they're the ones who have something to offer.
Yeah.
They have something to offer that the average person can't get themselves. The average teenager, the average young woman, college student. You know, there's this new crazy thing. It's not really new, but there's a crazy thing where all these wealthy men, and there's literally, there are flyers all over campuses recruiting college students. And all they get paid, all they have to do is go have dinner with them or like attend a party with them. Yes.
Like a sugar daddy type thing. Yeah. But
there's, yeah. And they literally openly recruit this on campus. And we have a friend whose daughter is in college. And she's like, oh yeah, I know all kinds of girls that do it. She's like, there's flyers all over campus.
Oh my gosh, that's horrific. And on campus? Oh my Lord.
And if you do not think that that doesn't lead to something else. I mean, they are so bold. The groomers and the traffickers are so convinced because most of the time, either the girl doesn't even know that she's being trafficked. She doesn't even know that's what the definition and what that's defined as, right? So they don't even understand it, number one. And number two, they're like, well, if this is being advertised all over campus, it's legal. Like, there's nothing wrong. Like, it's just dinner. Or he needs an escort to a party, right? He needs eye candy for a party. Like, and I can make $500. That's what they're seeing. They don't see what that leads to. And they don't have... The logic isn't there yet to understand, well, if he's that important and that good looking and he's got that kind of money, why doesn't he have his own date to go to this event or this party? Like, why does he need?
Why does he have to pay a young girl to go with him?
Right. Exactly. But they don't, that logic is just not there. And when they see other girls doing it and the other girls are like, oh my God, I made $1,000 last week. You know, when they see that.
And then they want to do it. Oh, I want to do that too. How do I do it? I saw that on, if anybody watched the Jeffrey Epstein documentary thing on Netflix, right? That's what he would do. Pay people for a massage and then recruit your friends and I'll give them some money too. You know, it's very impressionable on somebody young, especially if they're living off maybe their parents' money or now they have this big loan they have to pay back for college. That can be very daunting to think about, you know, trying to get through all of that. And it just shows how easy it is. All you have to do, like you said, is just dangle the right carrot.
That's right.
Say, oh, that's exactly what I need. Thank you for coming to my rescue. Yes. Exactly.
Well, and you get a situation where those girls are recruiting each other. Yes. And so he's not even paying a recruiter. Like, it's like giving candy to kids. Like, it's like standing on the street corner with lollipops and see how many kids come running to get a lollipop. It's the same thing with no effort. You know, these girls are telling each other. And, you know, he doesn't have to do anything.
Right. And like you said, they lack the correct terminology or just terminology and definition in general to understand that what they're doing now is, you know, recruiting for trafficking, which
that's
is
right.
Specific too.
Well, usually they've not gotten far enough into it yet to think it's harmful.
Right.
They have only done a few dinners. They may have gone to an award show or a Broadway play or something, right? A nonprofit event. Like, they've only done a couple things. And so they'll start recruiting while they think it is still innocent. And then it will turn sour quickly and it's too late. The ones that have been in it a while, they won't use them to recruit because they've already seen what it is. They're going to use the new girls and go, hey, my buddy needs a date for this event too. Do you have a friend? I mean, that's what they do in the beginning. So, you know, they use them to recruit and they don't even know they're recruiting.
So scary. And I'm so grateful that there's people like you out there just actively being a part of the community and educating and taking action. And, you know, I hope that this really inspires the people on the other end to think, wow, that doesn't sound so hard how she got started, or those little things she said don't seem so intimidating. I could do that, you know, and I encourage you all to go do it. Go put sticky notes in bathrooms.
Yes.
Here I'm with you. You don't even have to, we all stop and use the restroom at gas stations sometimes. Like, just keep some in your purse. Write them out on a piece and go stick them, you know, whenever you're there. And so exactly. I'm really grateful that you're out there doing this, Tracy. It's really refreshing. And, you know, it's nice to see people actually doing something and taking action versus, you know, stewing on it and feeling helpless. And I know that you're just getting started on your journey, and I'm really, really excited. Hopefully all this stuff can start coming into fruition. And when it does, and I say when, cause I know it's going to, I definitely want to have you back on and we can talk about, you know, more about what you're doing. And, you know, I'm just really excited and I'm really proud of you.
Oh, thank you so much. We just, we're obedient and we're consistent. We're going to be the hands and feet, and we'll be where we're supposed to be when we're supposed to be there.
You mentioned your website is probably the best way, I'm assuming, to get the book that you had shown behind the screen to find out information, to donate, to get in contact. Are you guys on social media anywhere else?
We are on Facebook.
Okay.
And that's the Ruby Organization.
Okay, cool. I'll post that also. And I'm going to post all her links in the show notes, you guys, her Facebook. Go connect, go support. It's so good to support these smaller organizations and nonprofits, especially like she said, they're not the ones getting all the millions of dollars of funding. They're trying to just even, you know, have their voice heard and to be known in their community. So all of our eyes help protect Tracy, protect your team, help protect the victims that they're going in and speaking to and helping. And obviously helps the organization grow. So you guys go support Tracy. And Tracy, thank you so much for being here. This was an honor.
Thank you for having me. This was great. This was great. Enjoyed it.
Me too, so much. I can't wait to connect with you again, and appreciate it. And you guys, thank you so much for watching and listening as always. God bless you all. And we'll see you next week.